Conducting an orchestra is seen as well as heard, and it's also largely misunderstood. Leonard Slatkin, music director of the Detroit Symphony Orchestra, sheds light on this most mysterious of professions in his book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro. Leonard Slatkin has held positions that include directorships with orchestras in Washington, D.C., St. Louis, Cleveland, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Los Angeles, and at the BBC. He's been nominated for 60 Grammy Awards, winning 7, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Maestro Leonard Slatkin to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us. I appreciate
it. Very nice to be with you.
It is great to talk to you, and especially after reading this book. At what point did you decide that there was something you wanted to clear up? Because it seems that is the motive behind the book.
Well, a lot of it started when I was running an orchestral institute for conductors in Washington. So that was about 6 or 7 years ago. And I realized that many of the things I was telling the young conductors were things that the general public really didn't seem to know much about, because we were focusing on matters not only related to the music, just simple things like how do you bow? How do you work with the librarians? How do you deal with the stagehands? Not that those are the only things that are misunderstood or not known, but as I began to put down all the things that I felt went into the profession of conducting, I began to realize that it was so intertwined with how I came to the profession that the book wound up being a partial memoir, partial autobiography, and informational book. So it's kind of three fronts going on here at the same time.
At what point in your life did you know you wanted to be a conductor?
I probably wanted to be one from a very young age when I started setting up a light in my bedroom, putting records on the phonograph and watching my shadow as I led performances by the NBC Symphony and Chicago Symphony. And I was about 7 or 8 years old. But I really didn't seriously pursue the career until after my father had passed away. He was a brilliant musician, violinist, arranger, and conductor. And there was so much competition in the family that I really didn't feel I could enter the profession. And sadly, he died when I was 19, but it did open up that door for me that perhaps would have been closed in other circumstances.
When you think about the act of being a conductor and teaching that to others, which you have done, what does it take? What are the ingredients?
A lot of it is outright objectivity, the ability to stand away from what you do and view others in the way that, say, the orchestral musician needs to see them. It also requires that you, in teaching anyway, stay away from judging people on interpretation. Your job as a teacher in conducting, I think, is really to understand what the musician wants and then find the tools to help them achieve that. In other words, I'm not concerned when I teach about how fast or slow something is, or how short or long or loud or soft. What I want to do is get to the heart of what the conductor wants to get, understand why they want to get it that way, and then help them to achieve that.
And your role with the orchestra is then?
Well, it's to convey basically your intentions. It's a little bit like the coach of a football team in that you work out all the things you're going to do by the time you get to the game, in our case, the concert. And of course, circumstances at the actual event itself can dictate certain matters about speed and volume, things like that, just as a football coach has to improvise depending on what he or she sees on the field. So I really believe the conductor's prime job and work occurs during the study and rehearsal process. By the time you get to the concert, there's not really too much you can do. All you can do is lead a kind of slightly different version of what you've already practiced.
How much is an orchestra the sound and the makeup of the players, and how much is it the conductor? In other words, when you go to conduct the Boston Symphony Orchestra, does that become a different orchestra under your baton?
I can certainly attest, not so much for myself, but having heard performances by conductors as diverse as Sir George Scholte and Eugene Ormandy, when they were standing in front of orchestras other than their own, within 10 and 15 minutes, the sound of those orchestras changed to be much closer to the sound that those maestros had with their own orchestras. And it's hard to know exactly why that happens. It is certainly a matter of the personality conveying itself through gesture, through head motions, through the slightest flick of the wrist showing something. But more than that, a great conductor not only tries to revel in the idea of interpreting what the music meant, but also the kind of sound an orchestra produces. Now, certainly that has something to do with the makeup of the players themselves, but again, a music director, which is another key facet of being a conductor for most, has to do with having a vision of what your orchestra will sound like. How can your orchestra be different from another orchestra? Otherwise, what would be the point in it if we're all the same?
How do you think people, or how do you describe your sound?
My sound is reflected primarily, I think, from my own background, which had a history of string players, primarily of Russian tradition via Hollywood. And that has affected at least the way I approach the strings. The strings are what make an orchestra an orchestra. A band is the winds and percussion. Now you add the strings to it, you have an orchestra. So what I try to do is to focus primarily on the string sound and have the winds blend into that. Where needed, of course, for solo passages and works that just feature those sections, of course you want them to be distinct and individual. But for the most part, I try for a homogeneous sound rather than a straight-out virtuoso sound.
You write in the book about several, as you say, it's certainly part memoir. You're writing about many of your personal experiences, including what happened at the Metropolitan Opera. And give us a sense of what happened and why that became a controversy.
Well, to start with, I was originally engaged to do a contemporary work by the composer John Corigliano. Budgetary reasons forced the Met to cancel that opera, but they wanted to keep the same participants if possible. And they switched the opera to La Traviata, which our principals primarily had done before, but I hadn't. What is not clear, of course, is that there were now limited rehearsals because you could put Traviata on far more times than you could go to Versailles. And I felt comfortable doing a work at the Met that I hadn't done before. I studied it well. I felt I was totally prepared in going in for it. And everything was fine for about a week. And then in the second week, as we got closer to the performance time, the soprano, Angela Gheorghiu, and I had some sort of unspoken feud going on. She would go off on vocal tangents that I simply couldn't figure out, and that was verified by many members in the orchestra who came up to me saying, we have no idea what she's doing and we can't follow her. And this is a work the Met plays every year. So if they couldn't get by it, I was certainly going to have a lot of trouble doing it the first time. Also, the administration of the Metropolitan Opera had come up to me at the dress rehearsal and between the acts of the first performance to tell me what a wonderful job I was doing. So I assume, you know, there were places that weren't together, but that was just the way it was going to be, and there was nothing you could do to fight the soprano at that time. A couple days passed, and probably the most scathing reviews I've ever had in my life appeared in the paper. And it was only then, after these reviews came out, that the Met asked that I walk away from the production itself. And the other part that's telling, of course, is that I actually got paid for the performances I didn't lead. And that kind of gives you the indication that it became the soprano saying, look, I can't work with him, and either he goes or I go. So I suspect that's what happened down the line. It became controversial simply because a so-called major conductor was doing a work at the Met for the first time, which I had chronicled in the blog that I kept. And I thought it was interesting because it would provide some insight for the readers to see what it's like to put on an opera. It was that was actually before I was well into the book, so I hadn't really thought about putting it in that way. But it became an important part of the book now, just so people could see the situation and travails we go through sometimes. The long term for me was that it may have been one blemish, but it was a very small blemish in what for me has been a very wonderful and satisfying career.
What does it say, though, in the rock, paper, scissors game of classical music of a conductor and a soprano?
Well, it's not that this is uncommon. We know of so many clashes between conductors and singers. In fact, a couple days after this happened, I got a message from Riccardo Muti, who was conducting the Philharmonic. And I didn't know him. I'd never met him. And he just sent a message through the concertmaster of the Philharmonic to say he understood totally, first of all, Traviata is the most difficult of the Verdi operas, in his opinion, and he vowed he wouldn't work with Miss Georgiou in the future either. So I guess I felt a little better. But somehow in the back of my mind, I think, you know, Angela and I had worked together before doing opera aria concerts, and everything was fine. And somehow I have this idea that maybe in a couple of years we might be working together again. Who knows?
The name of the book is Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro, and it's published by Hal Leonard Books. We should note that you also are going to be taking part in the John Williams 80th birthday celebration at Tanglewood on Saturday. How would you describe your relationship with John Williams?
It goes back before me. My parents were part of the studio film industry in Hollywood, and when Johnny Williams was just a pianist playing sessions, he worked with my parents regularly, and my dad died in 1963, so a lot of the major Williams scores he didn't do, but my mother did. And John tells this fabulous story about my mother being the cellist in Jaws. So she was the one who played da-da, da-da-da-da. And so a couple times I've been at performances where John plays an excerpt, and he tells the audience this story, and he says he just wanted everybody to know that from the point of Jaws, it's been my mother that's been scaring audiences all over the world. And, of course, I chime in from the audience and says, no, John, you're wrong. She was scaring people long before that. We go back a long ways. We partnered on a film festival, two-week sojourn in Washington. We've known each other for all these years. And I remember that in the year 2000, I was asked by Time magazine to name who I thought was the most influential composer of the 20th century. And I said, John Williams. They said, no, we didn't mean that. We mean like a Stravinsky or Schoenberg. And I said, you said most influential. I can't think of any composer who other composers want to emulate other than John Williams for many, many reasons. This man is so superbly talented in so many ways and so identifiable. I'm really thrilled to be doing this concert.
It is. We just had him on the show, and it's fascinating because I've never been in his presence where I haven't just felt in awe, number one, and number two, that I was almost reduced to tears, because he is so beautiful when he describes what it is that he does and the impact of his work.
Yes, it's exactly right. During our film festival in Washington, we had discussions with the audience after each performance. And one night, a gentleman said to John, didn't he feel limited by the constraint of a time value for each piece of music? In other words, he's not just writing something because he feels it. He has to write it because it has to be 35.2 seconds long. And John gave a wonderful answer, of course, explaining how he does it and how he works. And as he was answering, I thought, you know, what makes John great is the same thing that made a Bach great or a Beethoven great. They took their formal structures, in the case of Bach, say, a fugue, or in the case of Beethoven, a sonata or a symphony, which have set rules about how they have to go. And they transcended the rules. They didn't break them. They transcended them and made great works of art. And that's exactly what John does with film. He takes that not as a limitation at all, but as a challenge to create something fantastic in the time period he's allowed. And that's exactly what he does.
And you do have to parse it and look at the conductor and look at the composer, don't you?
Yeah, you do. It's a little different when writing for film, and John certainly grew as a conductor. Here was the case: when you do films, of course, you have to stay within the parameters of the time frame. You're stuck. And that is a little bit limiting interpretively. Sometimes, though, when I watch John, when he doesn't have the clock in front of him or the streamers or the click track, it's wonderful just to watch his pure musicality come out and show itself, where he takes a liberty here that he perhaps couldn't when he was conducting it in the films. I think, you know, this is the youngest 80-year-old I've ever met.
What can people expect from the birthday celebration at Tanglewood?
A lot of surprises, some wonderful video tributes, performances from the likes of Jesse Norman and Gil Shaham and Yo-Yo Ma. I'm joined by two other conductors, the assistant for the Boston Symphony and Keith Lockhart. And all in all, I think everybody who comes is going to be entertained, enlightened, and most of all, in a celebratory mood. It's going to be quite a night.
Do you enjoy coming to Tanglewood? I assume you've been on our program over there. Yes. I assume it's someplace you like coming back to.
Of course. It's one of the great venues. Perhaps the very most storied one in the United States in terms of summer. It reeks with the history of music in this country from its inception with Serge Koussevitzky and carrying right through Bernstein and Ozawa and Levine. The number of premieres it gives, the sheer importance of Tanglewood on the American scene make it a wonderful place to be. But this is the first time I've actually conducted the Boston Pops at Tanglewood, so that makes it a little bit different for me.
You also are going to be signing and talking about your book tonight at the Stockbridge Library at 6:30, and that's a very exciting as well, so people will get a chance to meet you in the night before the John Williams concert.
Yeah, it's a little hard now to think that people are going to look at my bio and say Leonard Slatkin, conductor and author. It's a little strange.
Did you ever think about kind of writing these secrets that people will look at a performance differently because they'll know what you're thinking in some ways?
It's not the same thing as a magician revealing the tricks.
Right.
Ultimately, the conductor is really a person who can't be described in words. You move your arms, you use your head gestures, you use your body language, and nobody can really say why one person makes it work so well and another one doesn't. But hopefully people will start to realize how much more goes into it. Again, the public just sees, in the most part, the end product, the concert, and they don't think so much about all the preparation and work that went into putting it together, whether it's a short rehearsal situation, as is in Tanglewood, or whether you have a week or 2 weeks to put together a performance. All those aspects of the rehearsal process, the preparation process, the study process, that's kind of what I try to bring the reader into. At least the average music lover, I think, can read this book very comfortably.
It's a wonderful way of describing it, of comfortably, because you end the book with 10 frequently asked questions, one of them being, do I need a baton? A very simple question.
Yeah, it is a simple question, but again, something people don't really think about. How do we choose to use one or not? Different orchestras have different responses to it. I've always gone back and forth. If I think the music doesn't really need to have the angular view of the stick, I put it down. You know, works like the Barber Adagio for strings, or even the slow movement of a particular symphony. Other conductors like Pierre Boulez, Leopold Stokowski did it without. But more important than that is every conductor must know how to conduct without the baton, because I guarantee you, at least once in their life, it's going to go flying during a concert out of your hand, in my case, into the audience a few times. And you just really have to know how to do this without the stick.
It's a lovely souvenir. And I hear always described as an extension of your hand, right?
It is. And when you don't have it, in a way, you have four more batons if you use your fingers as well. But really, for me, the ideal of a baton is just to think of it as the arm going forward and putting the focus of the musician's attention actually on your hand. When you say follow the stick, nobody really does. The stick goes too fast to really see it, but it does help to focus the musician's view on the center of the hand. So that's where your main thrust of your beat has to be for everybody to really play together.
Leonard Slatkin, musical director of the Detroit Symphony, will be reading from his new book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro, tonight at 6:30 at the Stockbridge Public Library. He will be performing as part of the John Williams birthday celebration tomorrow at Tanglewood, which is Saturday the 18th. And it is a great pleasure to have Leonard Slatkin join us this morning on the program. I thank you very much, and it's great to have you in the Berkshires, and it'll be wonderful to see you on stage.
Great to be back, and thank you so very much for taking the time today.
A great pleasure. Thank you very much. Again, the name of the book, Conducting Business, Unveiling the Mystery Behind the Maestro, published by Hal Leonard Books. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.